Mom, he's doing it again. Bandit, stop. When I was in elementary school, we thought it was a good idea to go get a puppy from the local shelter. It was a tiny, itty-bitty little cute thing weighing, I don't know, 4 pounds, and we were told it was going to be a very small dog. Fast forward 1.5 years from then, and that very small dog was a wolf. Thing was 50-plus pounds. Now, some of you are like, that's not a big dog. It's a big dog. It's a real big dog. And Bandit was not only huge, but he also had just some unique quirks. Like, I don't want to stay in the yard, and I like to run away all the time, and I like to be in the house even though I'm an outside dog. And he was just kind of dumb as a rock. You ever met one of those dogs? No matter what you do, you can't fix it. We couldn't train it for nothing. And one of the weird quirks that he had was that he really enjoyed eating his food twice. I'm glad you figured that out. And so, I wonder if he was supposed to be like a military dog because he like would always find landmines and just lap them up. And so we wanted to stop that behavior because it's gross. So we trained him, we disciplined him, we fed him different foods. We even consulted folks of like, why was he doing this? Well, he has an improper diet. You're not feeding him the right food. And what? And no matter what, he refused to stop and kept eating his own mess. And it made no sense. You're like, dog, you have this amazing food right here. Why are you going back to all that nastiness? It's because something was wrong in that dog. Okay. Abraham had the good food of the blessing of God, the promise of God that he would be the father of many nations through Sarah. And God has shown his immense power and mercy to him time and time and time again. And yet, as we will see in today's passage, that he continually returns to his own mess. And so in verses 1 and 2, we see that your mess follows you. From there, Abraham journeyed toward the territory of the Negev and lived between Kadesh and Shur, and he sojourned in Gerar. So from there, well, to where? What does that mean? Well, he was in the Oaks of Mamre. And he left there to sojourn in Gerar. We don't know why. Seemed like life was going pretty well in the Oaks of Mamre, but he decided to leave, something he kind of always did. He's in a place for a while. He goes elsewhere. Now, Gerar was a Philistine city. And if you know Israel's history at all, you know that the Philistines were often a quote-unquote thorn in the side of the ancient Israelites. And so the ancient readers of this Israel, Hebrew readers of this text would have been seeing Gerar, thought Philistines, and went, oh, something bad's about to go down. And the Philistines are going to come in and mess everything up. Let's watch how they do that. Verse 2. And Abraham said of Sarah, his wife, she is my sister. And Abimelech, king of Gerar, sent and took Sarah. Plot twist. It's not the Philistines that are the bad guy, but Abraham. Abraham's the bad guy. He lies about his wife being his sister, and now she's in Abimelech's household as one of his wives. And if you've been walking with us through Genesis over the past few weeks, months, you'll have a little bit of deja vu going on. You're like, wait, I thought we already heard this story. Well, you kind of did, because he did it before. When they were fleeing from a famine, they went into Egypt, and Abraham was afraid of the Egyptians. And so he decided to come up with this plan to say, hey, listen, Sarah, the Egyptians are going to kill me because you're so beautiful. They're going to want you to be their wife. So listen, here's what we're going to do. You just say you're my sister, and they won't kill me. And that same fear that led him to make that boneheaded decision back in Egypt is the same fear that drives him to be a fool now. Now, that was decades ago. When he was in Egypt, his relationship with the Lord was kind of new. He had just been called out of Ur, the place where he was born and lived a good chunk of his life. But now he's been walking with the Lord for decades since then, and he knows better. He's seen God do all kinds of amazing things. He knows God's character. But instead of walking in confident faith with the Lord, he cowers to a deep idol. But see, Abraham was pulled out of an idolatrous, moon-worshipping culture. okay? To serve the one true and living God. But he still drifted toward idolatry. His idol just changed. Instead of bowing down to Nana, the moon god, he bowed down to fear, to something in himself, to self-preservation, this deep idol. And this is a cyclical pattern in his life where he's not trusting the Lord in moments and turns into this pile of a little puddle coward. But this is Abraham. We've seen things he's done all throughout Genesis so far. He left his homeland, everything that was comfortable and normal, to go into literally only God knows where, into the unknown. He led 318 men tracking down powerful warlords, these kings that swept up cities along the way to rescue his nephew Lot, and he took them all out. This is Abraham who prayed that God would be merciful to Sodom if he could find any righteous one in there. So we see Abraham, when he trusts the Lord, he is this brave warrior who leads his household to do wild acts of faith. But when he doesn't trust the Lord, he is a coward who serves up his wife to a foreign king to protect his own skin. And so this act is a manifestation of Abraham's lack of trust in the promise of God. Promise that he would be the father of many nations. And I'm sure he rationalized this in the way, he's like, okay, listen, I can't be the father of many nations if I'm dead. Dead people don't reproduce. But instead of believing the promise and honoring the Lord in his marriage, he instead tries to finagle things for himself to save himself. And as Proverbs 26:11 says, he acted like this. Like a dog returns to his vomit is a fool who repeats his folly. So here's Abraham acting like Abram, who he was before. He's in a new place, but it's just the same old sins. So something we see is that our sin doesn't stay in Egypt. It follows us. See, we like to think that if we were in a different circumstance, we had more money, better friends, a more fulfilling work life, a better spouse, a better church, that we would honor God more. We would honor God better. We'd follow him more closely. But we see that's not true. We are who we are wherever we are. Doesn't matter if you're here or elsewhere. You know, there's kind of this ethos that's like, if I can just move to a new place, new me, right? New place, new me. And when you get there, you fall into the same old patterns that you did in the former place. Why? Because you are still you. And wherever we are, we can either trust in the promise of God or not. So the question that I just want us to consider is, think about your life. What shows a lack of trust in the promise of God? What are those deep idols that you just keep bowing down to? You keep returning to comfort you, to give you power and control, to be approved by your spouse or other people, or to keep you safe. Let's say you have a moment that God gives you where you can talk about your faith in the workplace or at the ball field or something like that. And you don't take it because it's just uncomfortable. Someone's eternal soul isn't worth your comfort. Or let's say that you're a man, you need to lead in the home, but you're like, I don't know, like that's really uncomfortable. I haven't been doing it. Like, how am I supposed to even try to do that? Or you crave power, your idol's power, and so you're just a jerk in the home, telling everybody what to do, bossing everybody around all the time. Not for their benefit, but because you just want to have control. You just like the power. Or maybe you're in school. Maybe you're younger, or maybe in your workplace. And there's things going on around you that are just patently wrong, and you're afraid to speak up about those things because you're worried something might happen to you. There's this issue of safety coming up. What if I get fired? What if my friends don't want to be around me anymore? I don't have their approval. And it's easy to look at Abraham here and go, There is no way on God's green earth I would do this. This is insane. And it is insane. It really is. But a good chunk of the reason why we see it so insane is because we don't, this is so weird in our context. Like, this isn't a thing that happens in our context. But apparently during this time, husband murder for marriage was a thing that happened. So it was a legitimate fear that Abraham had. He didn't just concoct this in his brain, right? He actually, this was a real fear. It was a cultural sin of this time period. And every culture's got their own kind of embedded sins, things that are just kind of in the culture. And I'm sure we could go on and list a whole bunch of them. You're probably thinking of some right now. You know, abortion is a huge cultural sin. It's covered up in the lie of bodily autonomy and those kinds of things. Just folks, you know, even like a very loose sexual ethic, just multiple people, kind of wherever, whenever. It's a cultural sin that's just latent, that's just in our culture. Or even like laziness, people just not wanting to work at all of anything, quietly quitting their job, or spending hours and hours and hours just mindlessly taking in entertainment and not producing anything for others' goods. There's all kinds of these cultural sins that are just in there. And we go, well, we're so much better than Abraham was in this moment, but there are so many ways in which we bow down to these cultural sins that we just are a part of without even realizing it. And that's why we need the Word of God to guide us and lead us, to prune us, to change us, to make us more like Christ. And even as husbands and men and fathers here, or maybe husbands to be or fathers to be, we have a unique application here. It's Father's Day, so I figured I'd. Yeah. While I guarantee you that there's no one that did exactly what Abraham did, there probably are ways in which we're selling our wives out to serve our deep idol. Like, hobbies are not sin in and of themselves, right? Like, things to do, like things we enjoy doing, they're not sin. But when you give yourself over to those things at the expense of spending time with your wife and nourishing your wife and taking care of her, you have now crossed the threshold and you're putting your wife on the altar of your own pleasure, your own enjoyment, your own comfort. Or maybe it's work. Work is a good thing. I literally just said we have a cultural problem of laziness, right? So now you're like, well, wait, I thought you said work is good. Work is good. So working hard is not the sin, but maybe the reason why you're working so hard is because you don't want to go home. You just want to stay where it's comfortable, where you're respected, where you're valued. Instead of going home and making that true in your home, you just stay in the office, or you stay at the shop, or you stay on the job site so that you don't have to go home and deal with it. Maybe you just go home and you don't do much. Now, I see a lot of men who are really trying here. But we have to be watchful that we don't slip into these easy ways of selling our wives out for our own comfort. And one of the things about Abraham is he was so successful. Like, unbelievable riches, power, and influence. When he came into this town, there's a reason why Abimelech went, oh, I got to figure this out. It could be even be the reason why he married Sarah could even be some kind of economic sort of deal. He's like, hey, I got to get in good with this guy. He's got a lot of money. He's got a lot of power. Let's make a deal, right? Because if you marry someone's sister, you have this bond in this culture and time. But though he was extremely successful, he consistently made a wreck of his home. And so being respected in your community, promoted in your company, lauded by your friends while failing in the home, it's like waxing your car while your house is on fire. You're making that thing look pretty, but it really, what are you doing? Your home's burning down. And so husbands, and then we'll talk about dads. I know 99.999% of the men in this room that are dads want to be great dads. And the best way that you can be a great dad is to sacrificially love your wife. That's what your kids really need. That's what they need to see. They need to see you protecting her, nourishing her, providing for her, even dying for her every single day. So we've seen how our mess just follows us wherever it is, and it comes from these deep idols that we carry with us. But now we'll see how our mess messes everyone up. We see this in an interaction between God and a pagan king. Verse 3, but God came to Abimelech in a dream by night and said to him, behold, you are a dead man because of the woman whom you've taken, for she's a man's wife. So God warns Abimelech that he's done wrong and will receive the most severe consequence, death, because God takes adultery personally. It's an affront on his character. He even wrote it into his law. When he gave Moses the law, adultery was punishable by death. And even before the law came, you can see that there's something going on here where the king of Gerar understood that this was a problem. He understood this. But the good news for him is that, verse 4, he had not approached her. The text tells us that Abimelech hadn't even come close to Sarah. As we continue, we'll see the text goes to great pains to reiterate the fact that Abimelech did not know Sarah in the biblical sense. Why does this matter? It's because God's promise is at stake. The promise that Abraham, not a pagan king, Abimelech, would be the father of many nations. So let's say that Sarah became pregnant, right? Even after she was restored back to Abraham. That would call into question who the father is, who the promise came through. And God is not going to let his promise look like a lie. So God confronts Abimelech to protect the promise. And Abimelech responds, and continuing in verse 4. So he said, Lord, will you kill an innocent people? Did he not himself say to me, she is my sister? And she herself said, he is my brother. In the integrity of my heart and the innocence of my hands, I've done this. So notice the question Abimelech asked God. Will you kill an innocent people? It's a strange question, but it's a throwback to the same question that Abraham asked of God regarding Sodom. In 1823, Abraham said, will you indeed sweep away the righteous with the wicked? And God says, no, I won't. And then so Abimelech appeals to God's justice. He's going, this is not just. Don't you understand what's happened? They lied to me. And what's interesting is that he doesn't say person. He doesn't say, will you indeed sweep away the righteous? He says, will you kill an innocent person? Why does he say people, plural, rather than why is he not talking about himself? Because he's a leader. And he understands that what he does, the actions that he takes, affects everybody who he's leading. So he appeals to God's justice and points out the wrong done to him and knows that it's not just his life at stake, it's his whole household, it's his whole community and the well-being of the people that he leads. And he says, hey, look, they lied to me. He said she's my sister and she said he's my brother. And notice that both Abraham and Sarah lied. That struck me as I studied this. I went, oh, Sarah lied too. Whoa. And I think that's significant that she was complicit in the ruse. Now, certainly, Abraham was the initiator of the lie all the way back in chapter 12. And then now in verse 2 of chapter 20, Abraham is the one who is ultimately responsible for this lie. He is the ultimately guilty one as the head of the household. But Sarah, out of fear of what would happen to her or her husband, or just because she just loves Abraham so much, whatever her motivation was, also lied. And this is challenging, but it is significant because we can make excuses claiming we're a victim of circumstances outside of our control. And sometimes those circumstances are outside of our control. Oftentimes they are. But what we see is that we still have a degree of culpability for what we do in those circumstances. And I know that's not really popular to say right now. What's popular is to say everyone's a victim and is a victim of some kind of system or bad actors or circumstances outside of control. And to a degree, that is true. There are real victims. Don't hear what I'm not saying. There are real victims. But the question is, what are we supposed to do in those moments? We still have a responsibility to obey the Lord inside those wicked circumstances, because Sarah was dealt a really bad hand here. You're kind of like, what is she supposed to do? What is she supposed to do in this moment? She was given to a foreign king by her husband. But like Abraham, she mistrusted God's promise and fell into the trap that lying was for the best. Here's the point. Our circumstances do not give us a license to sin. We can't think like it does, but we like to. And it ultimately comes down to this question, do you trust God's promise or not? In this moment, do you trust God's promise or not? So Abimelech protests God saying, I'm innocent. They lied to me. And God responds to Abimelech's protest. Verse 6, then God said to him in the dream, yes, I know that you've done this in the integrity of your heart. And it was I who kept you from sinning against me. Therefore, I did not let you touch her. God confirms Abimelech's innocence. God takes the credit for his innocence. Notice he says, it was I who kept you from sinning against me. Pause for a minute and just think about that. This is a pagan king. This is not someone, they had a kind of a cultural fear of God. They understood that this was of who was speaking to some degree. But these were not worshipers of the one true living God. And God kept this king from sinning. Think about this. I wonder how many times God has kept you from accidentally sinning against him. Changing your circumstances, directing your path, getting you stuck in traffic so that you do not sin. Obviously, there's no way for us to know this. It's incalculable, right? But just consider how merciful God is that he intervenes for us to keep us from sinning. Sometime last week, I had some of the boys in the van with me, and I was driving home from Lowe's, and we were coming across Baptist South Hospital. And all these cars were coming out of the hospital, just going, beating that light. They're done. They want to get where they're going. But at Intersys, that factory that's on the other side of the hospital, there's a semi-truck coming out. And that's a tight turn, and that semi-truck is making a wide, they're taking a long time to get around there, a big path, right? And these cars just keep coming. And in that moment, I'm just going, y'all are dumb. What is going on? And this judgmental, self-righteous, arrogant spirit, I mean, it didn't even come out of my mouth. It was just a moment, a feeling, this sort of just stupid people, right? And at that exact same moment, my son Josiah from the backseat, he's 2.5, he's got an Elmo upside down in his hand, a little stuffed Elmo. His rump is in the air. The Elmo's rump is in the air, and he's going, I poop on the potty! It was funny. It was hilarious. I died laughing. And in that moment, I know that's ridiculous. It's a silly example. But in that moment, and I don't know how all this works out with God's sovereignty, but what if that was God's kindness to me to stop me from sinning, from opening my mouth and saying something dumb, something sinful about these people that I do not know, putting myself over them as if I'm better than they are. So God stops Abimelech from sinning. But how did he stop him from sinning? Well, we don't actually know, and we'll get there in a minute. In verse 17, later on, Abraham prays, and Abimelech is healed. Well, healed from what? We don't know, but it was some kind of sickness, disease, or something that made it impossible for him to sin against Sarah in this way. And God caused it to happen. God caused this suffering to happen to Abimelech. Why? Because sin is worse than suffering. What if God doesn't only direct your circumstances and things around you to keep you from sinning? What if he also uses your suffering to keep you from sinning? What if you suffering to keep, what if God allowing you to suffer to keep you from sinning is actually mercy from him? See, sometimes we want God to show us grace in the way we want rather than the way that he does. So God confirms Abimelech's innocence, but he doesn't let him off the hook. Verse 7, now then, return the man's wife, for he's a prophet, so that he will pray for you and you shall live. But if you do not return her, know that you shall surely die, you and all who are yours. So God gives Abimelech a choice here. He says, you can either ignore my word or obey it. He's giving him a chance to make it right. And so remember what God said about Abraham in chapter 12. He said, I will bless those who bless you and whoever dishonors you, I will curse. That's what's going on right here. If Abimelech honors Abraham and returns Sarah, he will be blessed. But if he doesn't and he keeps Sarah for himself, he will be cursed. Even if he didn't know he did it. Why? Because God protects the promise. And God still holds him accountable, even though he is unaware of this sin. But look at the devastation Abraham's sin has caused. This is so significant of how deep this sin, how big the ripple effects of this sin is. His wife is in a foreign king's harem. Abraham's got no idea what's happening to her. The king, unaware of his wrong, has been told by God he's going to die. Literal life and death hang in the balance here. And then the stability of an entire city full of people is at stake because of this one lie. See, your sin messes everything up. And we like to play pet with our sin like it's a little house cat, something we can just play with and pet every now and then. But it's a lion that will kill everyone in your home and hurt everyone else around you. See, we have no idea the eventual consequences of our sin. Actually, I think it was last week too, but my family and I went to Camp Catalpa to walk around that little path that goes around, and there's a section where you're right next to the lake, and my boys like to grab gravel and try to skip these tiny little pebbles that never work. But I remember one of them grabbing just one single pebble and just plopping it in. There was this teeny tiny little bloop, you know, nothing. Even that tiny little pebble, there were still ripple effects. There were ripples that went out multiple feet, maybe 10 feet from this itty-bitty little tiny pebble. But our sin is not a little pebble. It's more like an asteroid. It destroys everything. But Abraham wasn't thinking about these consequences. He was just thinking about himself. What's going to protect me in the moment? So now we've seen that while our mess follows us and our mess messes everyone up, we get to see a confrontation between Abimelech and Abraham. And we have to understand that we make our mess. Verse 8, so Abimelech rose early in the morning and called all his servants and told them all these things. And the men were very much afraid. The people of Gerar believed God. Isn't that wild? Pagan nation, not following the Lord, but yet they respond with fear. Proverbs tells at the beginning that the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. They were wise enough to understand who they were dealing with. And they believed God by their fear. Why does this matter? Well, we're about to see that Abraham spins a deceptive narrative that flies in the face of reality. Verse 9, then Abimelech called Abraham and said to him, what have you done to us? And how have I sinned against you that you have brought on me and my kingdom a great sin? You have done things to me that should not be done. So he has a direct confrontation with him. What is your problem? What have I done to you? And the obvious answer is nothing. For all we know, the king of Gerar has only shown Abraham kindness. In verse 10, he says to Abraham, what did you see that you did this thing? What in our city did you see that made you think this was a good idea or that you should do this? And Abraham responds, and he's so out of touch with reality. Listen to what he says. I did it because I thought there is no fear of God at all in this place, and they will kill me because of my wife. Well, that's just clearly untrue because of the way that they responded to the word of God. The response of the people is faith in God, that he will do what he says he will do. And so the evidence of their actions is that they were at some level, God-fearing people. And this is to contrast with Sodom, who heard the word of the Lord, and they went the totally opposite direction. They said, we couldn't care less what God has to say. And what did God do? Wiped them off the face of the earth. So that's in these people's minds. They know who God is. You would definitely know about Sodom being wiped off the face of the earth. So they have this fear of God. But Abraham doubles down on his deception, lying not only about his relationship with Sarah, but also his observation of the people in Gerar. And you have to ask, if they were so wicked, why'd you go there? You just watched Sodom get blown up. Why would you go live with people that were wicked? You know what's going to happen there. And what we see is that Abraham's spinning a narrative about these people to justify why he did what he did. He is rationalizing his sin. And I wonder how many times you've done that, how many times I've done that, where we just make up reasons why we sin. We blame other people. We blame our circumstances. We blame something that happened to us during that day. I'm hungry. I'm tired. Did you know what they said to me? These kids are driving me crazy. My boss is a jerk. There's so many things that we can make up reasons to justify our sinful responses to things. If you have kids, you can see this. When you walk into their room, like they made a mess or did something we weren't supposed to do, and you're like, why'd y'all do that? And their eyes are just darting around like, come up with a reason. I don't know. Yeah, and they just make something up right there. But the only rational response to sin is owning it, confessing it, and turning from it rather than justifying it. So let's see how Abraham continues this self-deception, tripling down on the lies. He says in verse 12, besides, she is indeed my sister, the daughter of my father, though not the daughter of my mother. And she became my wife. He's trying to get off on a technicality here. It's a technical lie, right? But it's a whole lie. It's a true lie. Not a true lie. It's truly a lie. There we go. So his deceitful speech continues, revealing a half-truth. That Sarah is his half-sister. But he's, again, being deceptive about his deception. He's trying to squeeze it through on a technicality. But the issue isn't that Sarah isn't his sister, although that would be bad. The issue is that he didn't say she is his wife, and he intentionally withheld information to deceive. And so what we see is that half-truths are whole lies in front of the true and living God. Half-truths are whole lies in front of the true and living God. And see, the primary problem is Abram's motivation. What's going on in his heart? He's stating one side of the truth to only benefit himself. He is not considering the glory of God. He's not considering other people. He's considering himself. Now, he continues, and he quadruples down on the lies and makes the worst lie of all. Verse 13, and when God caused me to wander from my father's house, I said to her, this is the kindness you must do me. At every place to which we come, say of me, he is my brother. Look at the first seven words, specifically the third word of this verse. And when God caused me to wander, he's blaming God. Really? If you think about it, this is all God's fault. If he hadn't brought me out of Ur, we wouldn't even be in this situation right now. Abraham left Ur about 30 years before he came to Gerar. So he blames God, and then he says, this is what I said 30 years ago. So it's not personal. I didn't do this to you. This is what I do. This is my MO. So the summary of this section is that Abraham doesn't take responsibility for his lie, but instead he blames the people of Gerar. He tries to get off on a technicality and ultimately faults God for his own sin. And at the end of your self-justifying rationalizations about why you sinned is a finger pointing at God going, you did this to me. You made me this way. You put me in this situation. This is your fault. But there's only one person who's responsible for your sin. There's only one person who is responsible for my sin. Me. It is my sin. It is my mess. You and I made the mess we're in. And in and of yourself, you have no hope. You made this mess and you cannot clean it up. But what we're about to see is that God can. We see that God blesses even in our mess. Verse 14, then Abimelech took sheep and oxen and male servants and female servants and gave them to Abraham and returned Sarah, his wife, to him. And Abimelech said, behold, my land is before you. Dwell where it pleases you. What? This makes no sense. There's no transition. It goes from Abraham lying, doubling down, tripling down, quadrupling down, and then Abimelech blessed him. It doesn't even begin to make sense. It's scandalous. Abraham should have died here. He lied to a king, and he lied to the king, about the king, God. It's such a pivot. There's no transition. There's no conversation, right? There's no working it out or negotiation. It's just lies, blessing. It's wild. And the king of Gerar, after listening to Abraham be a terrible lawyer, throws open the door of blessing. And he gave Abraham sheep, oxen, and workers. This is physical provision for the long term. It's like giving him seed money for a new business venture. And he returned his precious bride, Sarah. But that's not all. As he gives Sarah back to Abraham, he looks her in the eye and he says, verse 16, to Sarah, Abimelech says, "Behold, I've given your brother 1,000 pieces of silver. It is a sign of your innocence in the eyes of all who are with you. And before everyone, you are vindicated." This thousands of pieces of silver was an unbelievable amount of money. It would be the equivalent, from what I read, to about 150 years of income. That's treasure and blessing that goes beyond the grave. It's a monumental, life-changing gift. Why? What did Abraham do to deserve this? Nothing. This is called grace. I think that's the reason why this part of the story is written the way that it is. It's because grace doesn't make sense to us. And it can kind of make us mad. Even when he's confronted and he has the opportunity to go, "You know what? I messed up. I'm so sorry. He doesn't. He continually lies. And then he receives more than what he had before. It seems unjust in our minds. Abraham should have been the one blessing Abimelech. "Thank you for not killing me." And yet it's the other way around. And I think that's why God wrote it this way, so that we would go, "Wait, what? Did that just happen?" It's like when you see a movie and like the characters are in one place and then all of a sudden there's a jump cut and they're somewhere else. You go, "Hang on, how did we get there? What happened? Let's rewind it. Let's make sure that this didn't skip or something. The stream didn't messed up." But Abimelech didn't bless Abraham because Abraham was so great. He blessed Abraham because God is so great. So Christian, you are blessed beyond your wildest imaginings. Because of Christ, you have forgiveness of all your sin, past, what you did a long time ago, present, what you're probably going to do today, future, what you will do before you leave this world. You have the purity and goodness of Jesus, the righteousness he has, the right standing before the Father that he has, you have. It's yours. And God, the creator of everything you see and don't see, the one who holds life and death in his hands, the one who spoke the universe into existence and holds it all together now, the one to whom you've rebelled against, says of you, "This is my beloved in whom I'm well pleased." And he's given you a sign, as Abimelech gave a sign of 1,000 pieces of silver to Abraham to show that Sarah was innocent, that she did no wrong. God's given us a sign. Verse 16, it's a sign of your innocence in the eyes of all who are with you. And before everyone, you are vindicated. Vindicated meaning acquitted of all charges, cleared of all wrongdoing. He's saying you have done no wrong. And these are the words of a pagan king to an unjustly treated woman. For the Christian, these are the words of the righteous king to a justly forgiven sinner. And our sign isn't a bunch of minerals pulled from the ground. It's a bloody cross, a resurrected man who came out of the ground, out of an empty tomb. So Abraham is blessed by God through Abimelech, and we see that he's restored to God in this verse 17. Then Abraham prayed to God, and God healed Abimelech and also healed his wife and female slaves so that they bore children. For the Lord had closed all the wombs of the house of Abimelech because of Sarah, Abraham's wife. The promise God made Abimelech in verse 7, he said that if you return her, I will bless you. I will, he said, this man is a prophet and he will pray for you and you will live. And that's exactly what happened. Abraham prays. Abraham remembers who he is. He's like, I'm the father of nations. I'm supposed to be a blessing to these people. So he prays to God. God is merciful and heals Abimelech and also his whole household. And God made it impossible for Abimelech to bear children. And now he makes it possible. But why? Why did he make that impossible? So that his promise would be protected. And there's a real result of faith here, a tangible flesh and blood evidence of God's promise coming true. Children. And we'll see next week that that promise didn't just come true for Abimelech and his household. It came true for the one that God initially gave the promise to, Abraham and Sarah. Sarah becomes pregnant. She is healed by the mercy and grace of God. And the promise is fulfilled. And this, I mean, she will have a flesh and blood, tangible evidence of God's grace in her life. And we have a flesh and blood Savior, God in flesh, who really came to fulfill God's promise that he would rescue his people. So trust that promise, because God always protects his promise. Even when you make an absolute mess of your life, Even when you are breathing chaos and despair, God will protect his promise. So you believe it. You trust Christ. You go deeper into that trust of Jesus, and you cannot mess it up. The promise is stated in John chapter 1, is that all who receive Christ, who believe in his name, he gave the right to become children of God. Sin is real. It's not a fairy tale. It's not just bad thoughts. It's not just things that we kind of mess up, like in a you could clean up your room kind of way, right? No, it's a burn the house down kind of mess. Maybe that's where you feel like you are right now. You feel like your house is just burnt down. Maybe sin, whether it's yours or somebody else's, has really hurt you. The good news is that God will bless you even in that mess. Trust Christ. It's not a generic blessing. Jesus is the blessing. He is God's gift to you, God in flesh, who really came, who was born of a virgin, who grew up as a kid, who had to be potty trained, who skinned his knees, who probably had to have his nose wiped. He had hair that probably got tangled up. He had emotions. He was joyful and sad and angry. He considered the scriptures and he prayed to his father. Why does this matter? What does it matter of Jesus, about the realness of Jesus, this tangible evidence of grace? Because the blessing you have in him is real. It's not fake. It's not just the power of positive thinking. It's not just some worldview that everything neatly falls into. You have a real Savior that is really alive right now and who is really interceding before the Father with you. And in him, there is only blessing, knowing God forever. That's way better than a few farm animals and some silver. It's eternal life with God. And we see sin's reality all around us, broken families, broken minds, broken governments, broken hearts. But Jesus can clean up all that mess and redeem it and make it for his glory and your good. And if you're in Christ, you are part of God's promise, and his promise does not fail. You can't mess that up. Abraham returned to his own mess, selling out his wife for his own self-protection. And Jesus was sold out by his followers to eternally secure his bride, the church. If you're in Jesus, you're free from the king of this world to follow the one true living king. We never figured out why Bandit kept going to his own mess. There's something deficient in him, a dysfunction. Who knows? But there's something dysfunctional in us, a sin nature that we cannot clean up, we cannot fix. Only God can. So trust him today. Trust Christ today. Put your faith in the one who can fix it all. Because he will, if you trust him today.